Sit down and buckle up. It's time for the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Welcome to another episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Hey, Nate Larkin here with your friend and mine, Aaron Porter. Aaron, it bummed me out that I was not present for your last conversation. You went ahead, you did a great job, and had that conversation with Tamara Rozier on your own, talking about ADHD and your brain is not broken. I wish I'd been a part of it.
Yeah, I've had many conversations since then with some people close to me, through stuff she said, and they were just like, oh man, she's putting words to my experience. Mm-hmm. And especially for one of them, my empathy of, okay, your brain works differently than mine. I need to stop addressing it as if you think like I do, and my insights and wisdom will be helpful. It won't.
Yeah.
Let's take a different path.
I wish I had had this conversation. I have started, I'm almost finished with a book now that is just, it's helping me. It's turning lights on. It's also kicking my ass because I see how I have been burdening people I love with my own organizational systems and then thinking poorly of them when they cannot maintain the order that I impose on their environment.
Well, because you are a convergent thinker and they're a divergent thinker. They can't help.
Okay. Yeah. So my wife, God bless her, is very much a divergent thinker. And I have a daughter who lives four doors away, very much a divergent thinker. So I found this great book. It's called Organizing Solutions for People with ADHD by Susan Pinsky. She's one of these, you know, organization experts. You can get a professional organizer.
What are we talking about? Like, I think of like organize your closet, your house.
Yeah.
That's what I always think about.
Right,
is that
right, right,
what
right,
you
right,
mean
right,
by that?
Right, right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and there are, you know, these poor people, they'll hire an organizer who'll come in and organize their house. And then, but then they can't keep up with the organizational system and the thing turns to chaos. And Susan Pinsky was one of those organizers until she had an ADHD kid. And then it was her education. It's like, oh, what works for a convergent thinker does not work for a divergent thinker. She didn't have that language. But at any rate, she totally rethought how she's going to organize a home for an ADHD person. And so I got some work ahead of me, Aaron.
Oh, man. I want to check that out. Isn't this the frustrating thing? And I think it comes not just with neurotypical and neurodivergent people that were like, oh, right. I have a kid on the spectrum, but they're really functional. So I didn't know they were on the spectrum and none of this is landing with them. And yeah. I'm getting angry and they're getting frustrated and moving away. But I think this comes into so much of life. I think about theology and people that have either been raised in one kind of theological culture or they found the new way, the right way. I got this book and this explains everything. And that God has wired us so differently. And the essence of the cross and the gospel and Jesus being enough and God's perfect love for us from all of these times in our life, where I might have been just sold on a certain idea and then later thought, oh, I don't feel like that's as important as I used to think it was. But how we interact with each other can either be so life-giving or so damaging when we understand we are just not wired the same way or we're not in the same seasons. So I'm loving these conversations.
Yeah. You know, I'm looking forward to this next conversation because we're going to talk to a woman about, among other things, female sexuality and what is the experience of, or what are the experiences, because women are different, around sex and sexuality in a way that might help us develop more empathy for the women in our lives.
Yeah. And if you're a woman listener, I hope it makes you feel like, okay, wherever I'm at is not weird and I'm not crazy. Because mm-hmm. you might have been made to feel like that and you ain't alone.
That's right. So stick around. You're going to enjoy this one. We'll be back in just a moment on the Pirate Monk Podcast. We in the Samson Society love our meetings. And we love what happens between the meetings, in friendships. We know that recovery requires relationship, that the opposite of addiction is connection. And we've also learned that there are times when we've plateaued in our recovery, or if we've suffered a setback, when it really helps to make a connection outside the meetings with an expert coach or therapist. And we've featured a lot of those people on this podcast, including the Hunters, Roan and Roe and Eva Hunter of LifeWorks Counseling in Madison, Mississippi. The Hunters are thoroughly Christian and fully trained, certified sex addiction therapists. They and their staff work with individuals and with couples dealing with addiction and with betrayal trauma. And you don't have to live in Mississippi to see them. You can actually reach them at lifeworks.ms and connect with them through telehealth. And you may not need to commit to a long-term connection with them. Maybe what you need is to attend one of the several intensives that they run each year for the Samson Society. To reach the Hunters at LifeWorks, simply go to lifeworks.ms or give them a phone call at 601-790-0583. That number again, 601-790-0583. LifeWorks Counseling is a sponsor of the Pirate Monk Podcast. Welcome back to the Pirate Monk Podcast. Our guest this week is a remarkable woman. She is joining us from none other than Bountiful, Utah. Her name is Rachel Allen. She's a CSAT, among many other things, and a former Alabama native, has spent some time in Tennessee and married, moved herself out to Utah, where she works with many a client. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking some time to talk with us.
Yeah, not a problem.
Now, yeah. I'm so excited about this week because Nate and I used to have a guest that came on fairly regularly and would kind of update us on changes that had occurred in our culture concerning women and sexual addiction, women and pornography. And we have not had that in a while, which feels like you're about to go see your nephew that you haven't seen in like 5 years. And you're like, oh my gosh, you're so much older.
So much has changed.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
excited to hear about your expertise, but can you give us some of your story first? Because this, we're always interested in how people come to this place where they want to serve other folks within this community of people who are facing down things that a lot of people don't even want to talk about.
Yeah. My story starts with, I started out as a fine arts major in college and I took a psychology class because you have to, right? Like it was basics.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, I just want to stick with the fine arts college because that either explained the story or didn't explain the story. And I'm not even sure where to go with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot. Like, if you have ever done like music or art majors, like they're very intense, and mm-hmm. there's a lot of dysfunction in mm-hmm. art, theater, music, right? Like, there's just a lot of dysfunction there. And I like the idea of being able to understand the human mind was fascinating to me. So I changed schools and majors and became a psychology major. And I met a professor at my second school who was very vocal and very open to talking about sexuality and sexual health. And I had had some of that. Like, my mom was pretty open sexually and very, like, she tried to give us open dialogues and open conversations. But that was a big juxtaposition from what I was experiencing with my friends who were going through awful dating relationships and awful, like, didn't know about their bodies. And it, it was just a very, like, perfect storm of, like, understanding human behavior and understanding sexual behavior, like, are so integrated. We can't do one without the other. Mm-hmm. And I had some personal experiences and kind of professional experiences during that time because I became her professor assistant. So I was helping her with her human sexuality classes and building curriculum and reading a lot of books. And I think for me at that point, like, it made sense to, like, if we were going to fix the problem, then we're going to have to address it directly. We can't, like, keep skirting around this, like, elephant in the room and the elephant get fed or get mm-hmm. taken care of. And so I wanted to have some very direct conversations about that.
Can you take it back to that comment that your mom tried to have open I feel like there was a nuance in what you said. Maybe it comes up later, but I feel like you were both trying to honor her and my mom didn't get it.
My mom actually did a really good job with me. She was very open. My mom's a nurse. She gave me a lot of, like, medical terminology. She was very open mm-hmm. with us understanding our bodies and exploring that. My mom didn't believe in waiting for marriage. Like, that was a, like, hey, this is something that you might choose to do, and it's probably a really healthy thing to do. But if not, like, let's talk about what it means to, like, be in love with someone and actually have sex with them and safety. So, like, my mom did a really good job in that way. But my mom was also working under the guise of, like, I grew up in a pretty conservative culture. And at that time, like, purity culture was really, really big. So, like, mm-hmm. the idea of talking about sex, the idea of female masturbation, the idea of, like, women owning anything sexual of their own was just not, like, so my mom was, like, really trying to, like, insulate this around a culture that just wasn't there.
So did you grow up in an evangelical culture?
Yes. Or, okay. Yeah. Yeah. So I grew up evangelical, charismatic. And yeah, it was like, it was the 90s. So we had a lot of, like, weird cultural stuff going on with, like, Britney Spears and stuff like that. And
then,
like,
Britney Spears against I Kissed Dating Goodbye at the same time.
Right. Yeah. It mm-hmm. was that was my childhood. Right. And so my mom really did, like, she really did try. There was just so much. And my dad was on the other side of that. Right. Like, my dad was very much like, sex is for marriage and, like, we don't talk about it and we don't, you know, like, mm-hmm. my dad was very much like, you are my little girl. I do not want to think about you as a sexual human being. And therefore we will have no conversations about dating and relationships.
Well, and you mentioned masturbation for females, which I think is such an interesting caveat to that, where, like, explain what you felt growing up. There seems to be a difference where it's like, oh, boys, of course they do. Oh, girls, what does that make you? I don't know. You tell me. I'm not a girl.
Yeah. I mean, God help me if my friends listen to this podcast, but I had a friend in college who, like, I loved her and I adored her, right? But, like, she absolutely believed that women could not masturbate. And
when you say could not, like not allowed, like, or couldn't physically do it?
It wasn't physically possible.
Okie doke.
Okay.
And so, like, when we started talking and I started explaining masturbation to her, because I was that person. I sexually educated most of my high school and my college friends. She was like, oh, I do that. And I was like, well, that's masturbation. but, like, at least in my youth group, in my, like, world, right? Like, it was not talked about in terms of, sure, like, what girls did, what it looked like, what it could look like. It was just that women don't do this. so it's not a female problem. Your job is to hold the gate for the boys who just can't control their sexuality. So you have to have yours under tight, tight wraps. And I think that created a lot of sexual anorexia for most of the girls that I knew.
Okay, define that term. It's never been said on this show ever. Sexual anorexia.
Okay.
Define it.
So this is a term from Patrick Carnes, in which like he would define it as a flip side of sexual addiction, where sexual addiction is like compulsive sexual activity. Sexual anorexia is the compulsive absence of sexual activity. We start to demonize it. We start to hate our bodies. We start, right? Like, it's kind of like if you did the addiction cycle in reverse, where we hit shame and the shame becomes the acting out behavior, right? Like, I'm so pious because I'm not acting out. And then I get a hit off of that. And then, right, then I spiral into shame more because it also feels incongruent with my body. And so we just kind of live in this, like, I refuse to be sexual. I get a hit off of that. And then I spiral into shame because that just, like, I'm not living in, integrated with my body.
All right. So you're in college. You're studying psychology. You haven't heard that term yet because you haven't done your CSAT training. But you are awkwardly educating your friends that they are masturbators and didn't know it. All right. So I've caught up with your story so far.
And then I had... I knew I wanted to go into like sex therapy. And for my side of things, I felt like if I'm going to talk about sexual health, I've got to address the unhealthy sexual parts. And then I kind of deep dived in that. I went to grad school. I started reading a lot about sex addiction and sexual health and things like that before I even got to grad school. Went to grad school and I got placed actually where I work now. It was called Pathways to Healing at the time. Now it's called Healing Paths, but my supervisor was a CSAT. And in my training, my internship, right, I just read everything I could from Patrick Carnes, from Marnie Faree, from Pia Melody. Like it was just, it was like a whole group of people that I had not been exposed to that just like it clicked. It made sense, right? When you start reading things like Patrick Carnes' Betrayal Bond and you start to understand like, oh, addiction is really like this, these broken attachment wounds that we're trying to repair. It just made sense. And so I stayed, I got my CSAT, and I started really working with a lot of female partners and addicts. And that was kind of an accident. Like, I didn't really go into this thinking, like, I'm going to work with females almost exclusively. And I don't. Like, I have about half and half male addicts and partners and female addicts and partners. But no one was treating female addiction the way that we were treating female addiction. And I started to realize, like, it's really unsafe for women to come forward and say, like, I'm a sex addict because, right? Like it just is.
What do you mean by unsafe?
I mean, so most, like if you think about it, most SAA and SA 12-step groups are mixed groups, but they're only mixed groups when one woman shows up. So you're putting a female sex addict in a group of like 12, 13 male sex addicts. And most females, in fact, like, I can't say this for sure because I've never worked with female sex addicts 100, like across the board on all of them, but every single one of mine in the last 12 years has had major sexual abuse and trauma stories. And so, right, like it becomes a sexual reenactment. And so it's a very male dominated space. The literature is very male dominated. And most women just don't feel safe emotionally with that. And then when you get things like it's an addiction, so there is compulsive acting out, and because the statistics of rape and sexual assault are higher in women in general, and females also tend to take things off of line into actual relationships faster, risk is higher. And so we may be sexually acting out, get to a point where we're uncomfortable as a female and don't feel like we can back out, or don't feel like, right, feel like it's our fault that we then experience sexual assault or get raped or like whatever that is. And so then it compounds. And so there's some really complicated pieces where we have to start parceling out what was my ownership in this sexual compulsive activity and what was abuse that I am now surviving.
Mm-hmm. So you're kind of describing two different kinds of women right now, or throughout what you've said so far. There are a lot of women that I've known that struggle with some, I'll even say sexual identity, whether it's compulsive behavior, whatever, that has a narrative behind it, where I find it is less common with guys. Sometimes it has like a seminal event. Other times it's like, this is what I wanted. This is when I started doing it. And they can dig deeper and find, oh, this does come from a place of pain. But it usually is that narrative piece for women I've found is more common. But then you're also talking about women who grew up in a situation like you were in, where it might not have a specific event they go to, but they just say, yeah, I was just confused about this whole thing. Nobody explained it. So, but those are two very different kinds of stories. So from your perspective, I'm very curious about that narrative piece for women struggling with sex addiction and like, okay, here's the statistics are very different between men and women. Will you talk a little more about that?
Yeah. So one, I think that women being ill-informed about sexuality puts us in dangerous situations with our sexuality. And I think that idea of, right, because I think that there is a level of this of like when we don't talk about it, like the culture that I was raised in, right? We didn't talk about female sexuality in any kind of healthy way. And that's my experience for most women who also like feel highly like, I want to have sex. Sex is good for me. Like it becomes compulsive or may have, and maybe it doesn't, right? Like maybe it doesn't become compulsive, but like when there is a like, this is something that I am experiencing in my body and my culture says that I cannot talk about it in any capacity. Mm-hmm. We get some really weird narratives going on in our head, right? And so you layer that with any kind of sexual abuse or sexual assault, and we also now can't talk about that. We'll blame ourselves. We'll convince ourselves that it's just because I'm a sexual person and I just put that energy out there. And so I need to control that. And so as long as I'm the one doing the controlling, like I'm not going to get hurt. And so
that's weird. That's weird because I hadn't thought about like that before, where in a Christian high school, it's, hey girls, dress like this, because evidently you have so much control that if you dress a certain way, guys won't lust after you, guys won't. So you are the person in control. Well, at the same time, it is a completely male controlled environment. Like those two things actually don't go together, but they're absolutely taught together. That's weird.
Right. And so, and I think that that's the hardest thing. Like, and I talk a lot about rape culture and purity culture and how those things like align and coexist in really toxic ways, because the narrative is the same for women in both. For women, the narrative is you can control men's thoughts, and if you can't, that's on you. And here are all the ways to keep yourself safe. And if you're not safe, that's actually not their fault. It's your fault because we're magical, apparently. I don't really know how that works, but like, right, somehow we have the ability to hold the thoughts and feelings of other people. And so if we don't do that well, then something breaks in us, right? Because then we're the problem of our own, like we're the cause of our own victimization or the cause of our own assault. And so it creates some really, really weird narratives in the female brain just to survive, right? Just to make it us function as adults and be able to be like, I can go to the grocery store and be safe. right? Like we will jump through all kinds of hoops when that kind of stuff is playing around in our mind.
It's very confusing. Mm-hmm. You used a phrase though, rape culture, which certainly a lot of people have feelings about because they're like, well, we don't have a rape culture. If you rape someone, you'll go to jail. So this isn't people saying, yeah, it's okay to rape people. I don't think that's what you mean. So for the person who's like, oh no, she said that word, she must be, and then insert whatever title they want to put, explain it to them.
Right. Yeah, full disclaimer, I'm not pro or against anything. I think that when you're talking about a culture of rape, right, it's this idea that we teach women how to stay safe and to try to control things that they really have no control over. And so...
Such as men's thoughts.
Such as men's thoughts. Or like, you know, if you wear a certain top to out to dinner with your girlfriends and a guy hits on you, like that's your fault because you wore a top and you were attracting a certain type of attention or whatever that is, right? It's this idea that if you don't do enough to keep yourself safe, then whatever happens after is still your fault. And some of that shows up in like ways that we ask questions of victims. Right. Like if you look at a lot of police departments are changing the narrative, but like if you look back even like 10 years ago on questions that they would ask victims, right, it would be like, did you lead them on? Did you give them any idea that you might be interested?
What were you wearing?
Like, what were you wearing? Right. Like, how were you acting? How much had you had to drink? And all of those things, like put in another scenario, we wouldn't ask, right? Like if someone gets murdered, we don't ask, what were you wearing?
Right. I got mugged.
Right. No one asked, like, well, how much did you have to drink?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe you wanted to give them your wallet.
Mm-hmm. Did you give them the idea that you were giving out, you know,
wallets,
free identity? Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's fair, but you also mentioned that that is starting to change. Tell me about that as well, because I think the Me Too movement seemed like an awkward step forward.
It was a very awkward step forward. It was messy, and I think it was needed. Right. So in my state, in the state of Utah, we were backlogged on rape kits, which are, medical kits that you go to the hospital when you have experienced rape or sexual assault, and they, you know, take samples from underneath your nails and skin, and like they collect things, right? Like they take pictures of any bruises or markings or things like that. And then those things go into a kit that go to the police station, and they're put in cold storage so that they can be processed, so that we don't lose any DNA evidence. And in our state, I think we were backlogged almost a decade. And that's pretty common. Yeah. Oh, so like a decade of rape kits had just not been done, right? And so when you're looking at like people getting justice or people getting like answers or closure, like that just wasn't happening. Now, after the Me Too movement, that came to light in our state. That was a very like, look how many rape kits that we have completely unprocessed that we're not like prioritizing. And we know, right, that statistically speaking, this is not every person, every man is not raping, right? Like we know that. Mm-hmm. But we do know that if it happens once from the same person, it's probably going to happen again if they don't get caught. Right. So mm-hmm. the possibility of that being like a serial issue that we could catch if we processed 10 years ago, is higher, right? And so when the Me Too movement came out and that came to light, the state prioritized that. And now we are caught up on rape kits.
Okay.
And those are being processed as, which is a huge thing, right? And again, Me Too was messy, but like it brought to light some things that needed to happen.
Most of these questions are clearly me as a guy trying to catch up with understanding stuff. So I want to move to speaking to women, but first, from your heart as both a therapist who's worked with men and women, and this has been your passion and desire. What would be the thing you would like men to understand and process through and sit with a little bit? Like, what would be your, hey dudes, you're listening from my heart to yours?
That would probably be like, let's get a very clear working definition of informed consent. Right. Like, consent does not look like in the moment when you've already started moving, asking, is this okay? Consent does not look like if I'm coercive and you say no, and I get emotionally volatile later, or I punish you later. Consent is, hey, let's talk about this thing. Are you okay? Do you feel safe? Like, do we have a stopping point? Do we have a safe word? Right. And I internally don't believe that it's possible for us to consent if like we need to know where we're at in our bodies. Right. And so like, I don't think that it's possible to consent if like we're dissociated or if we're having a trauma response. And I think it's important to check in with your partner multiple times. Like, hey, where are you at? Are you okay? Like, what does this look like? Right? Are you comfortable? And just kind of moving in, understanding that like women should have the right to say no at any point of the process, well, and shouldn't get punished for that.
And what do you, you've just,
really anybody should.
You've just reminded me of one of the most haunting conversations I had with a college woman that I had known since they were in high school, and they came pretty broken from a sexual experience they had, where they did not feel like they had been taken advantage of. What she said was, I had always been told I could say no at any point. I was never told that I would reach a point where I didn't want to say no and I would regret it. And yeah. I was like, oh my gosh, that's a crazy, like, I didn't even know what to say because that was felt so true, but didn't fit in. But it kind of right. fits with what you're talking about.
Right. And I think that there is, I mean, because we are talking, I mean, we're talking about messy things, right? Like, sexuality is messy, and human beings are messy. And when we get into like the feeling of like, I need this, or I deserve this, or like, you gave me signals, or like, I'm not sure where I'm at with this, but I like you. And like, this is crossing my personal boundaries, but like, I don't want to upset you because I love you. And like, that gets real messy.
Yeah. So you can fix this, because the messy that I'm hearing you talk about is, I wouldn't call the guy that she was hanging out with a rapist, because she clearly was like, yes, I got to this point that I'm saying yes, but there was no intimacy like for him. Knowing the backstory, it was, I'm excited to push this experience to here. It was all about the experience. It wasn't about a man saying, what is my responsibility in this? And not taking away her autonomy to have her own responsibility. And I might not be a rapist, but as a man, I want to be present. And if something's intimate, it should be intimate in the mind first, not just trying to figure out how to coax the body. I don't know. I'm hearing a lot of deep manliness for the men listeners. It's about serving and caring somebody else's, their heart, their needs.
Yeah. I mean, I really, truly believe that sex is an act of like, person-to-person contact. And anytime we dissociate, or our partner dissociates, or it gets mm-hmm. coercive, right? Like, anytime it's about like pushing an agenda or pushing a line, you have lost sight of the person you're with, right? Yeah. Like, I like the idea of like, hey, what are we good with, right? Like, I believe, and I teach my clients this, and I do this on a personal level of like, that changes. Where we're at one night is going to be different than the next day. And having those conversations of like, this is what I'm feeling today. This is where I'm at today. This is what I'm okay with. There is a video on YouTube, and I just think it's delightful, but he's talking about changing the narrative of how we talk about sex and sex ed from baseball to pizza. And because pizza is a collaborative experience, right? If you're going out to pizza with someone, like you're agreeing on a time, you're agreeing on a place, you're agreeing on the kind of pizza that you're sharing, you might go half and half, right? You might have some negotiation of like, I feel really comfortable with this and you feel really comfortable with that. Like what's in the middle, or can we try something? And then if you don't like it, like that's fine. You didn't like something new, but thanks for trying it. Like, which feels a lot more collaborative and relational than there's a lot, right? There's a base and I'm trying to get to a base.
Well, so Nate, I'm curious, because thinking about purity culture, as with all legalism, we shortcut conversations with rules. We can skip over conversations because it's just, you're allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. And then you figure out how to get as close to the line as possible, as if you're not going to cross the line once you get there.
Right.
So what are your thoughts hearing this?
Well, I mean, I just love the fact that we are actually having this conversation, because the culture in which I was raised and the culture, frankly, the culture in which I raised my kids, because, you know, I didn't even hit recovery from my own sex addiction till my kids were out of the house.
Wait, the rules didn't keep you safe, Nate? What?
Oh, golly. Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's marvelous that we're having this conversation. Yeah.
All right, well, let's shift to the women before we run out of time, because, yeah. I mean, come on, so many women. You talked about the female masturbation. I've mentioned on this show before, I have a folder full of weird things that I got when I was a pastor, and one of them was two youth group girls who cut and pasted all the letters, like a ransom note, onto a page, slipped it under my door, asking about, can we talk about girls and masturbation? And I still have that letter. They're like, we don't want you to know who we are. So it's isolating, right? They feel like I must be the only one. So speak to that, because I also know the world is changing as far as the amount of young women who are engaging in pornography is far different than it was 15 years ago. So let's speak to the women out there and how they might be feeling.
First of all, like, to those women, to those girls who are probably now women who were brave enough to like ask that question, being scared, like, I'm so proud of them. I think the rise of the internet has done some really good things and it's done some really bad things. And one of the really good things that I think it has done is it's given women access to information about their own bodies that we did not have before. Because the information that women had pre-internet was based on research and medical professionals specifically making it and gearing it towards men, right? So female sexuality was in the context of male sexuality, always. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to the point that I have talked to lesbian couples who are just like, really frustrated because of the whole like kink of like female on female porn. And they're like, that's not even made for us. Like that's also made for men. So like that narrative was very small of like what female sexuality looked like outside of male sexuality. And then the internet happened and we had women talking and sharing stories in a way that they had never been doing before. We had access to understanding how our bodies worked and asking questions as of this year, our president just like signed a bill that's to fund research for menopause and what happens in the mature female body, which has never been done. Like that's a huge historical thing. And so like the internet created a lot of ways for women to talk and learn about their bodies.
You are saying that there's never been a menopause study?
There has never been a government-funded menopause study. And most menopause studies are very fractured because most medical studies, hormone fluctuation makes it harder to actually get a viable study. And so that's what menopause is. So they don't know what's viable and what's not.
So this is affecting half of our population. I don't know exactly what the male, but... you know, it's affecting every
52%.
Woman. There you go, 52%. Mm-hmm. And I guess the male version of that study is, why is she so annoying during these years and doesn't mm-hmm. help the woman? Okay, that's actually pretty baffling. You've kind of sold me on your point with there's never been a funded study for that. But okay, go on. I'm going to sit here baffled.
Yeah. So good things happen with the internet. But it also made porn very accessible. And when we have culture, when our culture tends to be very rigid about the information we give women about sex, and you Google it, you get porn.
Yeah.
And so you have it's the same thing that happens with boys. You get curious, no one's talking to you about it, and Google is an education resource. So you're mm-hmm. going to go there, right? And then that becomes your definition of sex. That becomes your definition of intimacy. And sex is porn is violent, and porn is really, really misogynistic in a lot of ways. And it's yep. very damaging to female sexuality. But if you're taught that that's your norm, right? Like yep. that's what is expected as a female. And I think it's damaging to men too. I'm like across the board. I think the information that we get about what sex is in porn is damaging to both men and women.
Yes.
But there is a fundamental switch there that happens for women where then they think that they deserve to be abused and they think that they deserve to be mm-hmm. talked down to and belittled and right. And so then they end up in toxic relationships in which abuse and assault happen.
Yeah.
And they think that that's normal. And then we like perpetuate that. And so then we get an adult female who is in really toxic, highly volatile, abusive relationships. And she's trying to like, and sex feels good because it's supposed to. And so there's this like weird branding that happens in our brain in which like, sex becomes both the thing that is abusive and the thing that is desirable. And so it gets mm-hmm. fused. And so when we are treating that, when we are talking to women who are in those kind of relationships, right, we will see a lot more like love addiction flavor where they're trying to make a cosmic lover. Or make their partner what they want or like just being delusional about what the partner is so that they can deny the amount of abuse that's happening in the relationship. But we also see a lot more like high risk behaviors because they're right. That's just what's expected of them. They are a sex object to be put in high risk sexual behaviors. And then if you go back to porn, right, like that just reinforces it. And so like, it's cyclical.
So can you fix this thought for me? Cause I'm sure there's a more nuanced way than my young brain when I was working with college students especially, came up with, as I encountered different women who wanted to process through stuff, I seem to run into four categories. This is obviously very general, and please be nice, be gentle. I was like in my mid-20s trying to figure this out. I met women who had suffered trauma, had suffered abuse. And they tended to either hypersexualize that to feel like they're in control of it, or they just shut that down altogether. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there were a lot of isolated feelings for both of them, didn't want to talk about it. Then I met women who, probably a hormonal thing, they were just way more amped up about sexual things. And especially in the church, they didn't feel, you know, they'd join a small group and want to talk about masturbation, and they felt like all they saw was looks of horror on other women's faces. This is a long time ago, so these statistics probably changed. And then there were a group of women who were fairly ambivalent. Like, they were, at least what they were showing was, yeah, I'm going to get married. That's going to be a part of marriage. It's just, you know, they weren't like anti-sex. They weren't pro-sex. They weren't thinking about sex all the time. So those seem to be these four categories of women that I would run into. But anytime sex was really near the surface for those three groups, they felt very isolated. Mm-hmm. So clean that up and tell me about, Is it less isolated now because women are talking about it more because of the internet? Is that a good thing? Or does it still bring those same types of feelings?
I mean, I think it depends on what algorithm you're in all respects, right? Like, I think that unfortunately we are, like, the internet is full of really, really valuable information. The internet is also full of really, really bad misinformation. And yeah, you can't always tell what is accurate and what is not. I will say, right, like, it's normal for, you know, college girls to have a range of sexual desire, just like it's normal for male college students to have, it's normal for human beings to have a range of sexual desire, from like, I don't feel like it and it's fine, it's not really on my like to-do list, versus like, wow, I really like that and could probably do it every day and like be real happy. And like, that's pretty normal. Like, that's a normal scale for people, right? Now, in my experience, like, I could also eat ice cream every day and it's not really great for me to eat ice cream every day. So like, right, like, you want to like pair that and like base that on your partner and like create some space for that. I think in my experience, right, yes, I think that women have, yes, you have the group that are like extremely traumatized and either hypersexual or shut down, which, right, like, I think that that's where we get into compulsivity and anorexia. And then I do think, and I don't think we talk about that group in context of like, that's at least 1 in 4 women, right? Based mm-hmm. on statistics, 1 in 4 women by the age of 18 have been sexually assaulted or raped. Mm. And that's reported in what we know of, right? So that is a fourth of the culture that reports this. Mm-hmm. So that is a fourth of women. And then you're going to have women with higher sex drives. And if you don't have anybody talking to them about it, and they're actually told like, actually you can't talk to them about it, you will get this, like, I am just more like a man, mm. or like, maybe there's something broken in me, yeah. right? Like, I shouldn't mm. feel that.
And once they're married, oh my gosh, the marriages where the guy had a lower sex drive and the woman had a higher sex drive became some of the most awkward conversations, because they felt like that was something wrong with them because it's reversed somehow. And that's so many women.
Right. And that's so broken, right? Like, again, like, everybody is going to have a different level of sex drive because we're human. And, mm-hmm. you know, like, and I tend to stay away from the term sex as a drive, because I don't believe that we need sex to survive. I think of sex as a, like, reward center overdrive. And that's actually kind of where it shows up in the brain, is in the reward center part of the brain, not the drive center part of the brain. But like, right. Like, so yeah, like, some people, like, my husband also loves ice cream. My husband would have ice cream like once a week, and that would be good for him. Right. Good mm-hmm. for him. I could literally eat ice cream every day, and that's not a euphemism. I'm actually talking about ice cream. I want to be okay. clear.
fair enough. See, you're sensitive to us. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm using that as an example, right? Because the reality is we all have things that, like, it's just part of our desire and interest in our arousal template. And recognizing that everybody's going to be a little bit different.
Right. You don't put an identity attachment to your ice cream desires like people put to their sexual desires. What does this mean about me because I have these desires? You're like, everyone has lots of desires, and most of them don't come with an identity attachment.
Right. And I would say too, like, yeah, like, I think that a lot of women have like, you know, that third category of like, yeah, something I'm going to do with my husband, for my husband, whatever. And like, one, I don't think that sex should be done for anyone. And I want to clarify that, like, that is just a really bad dynamic that we create in partnerships.
But even for those that are like, no, this will be a good part of marriage, this is something we'll do together. And yeah. I shrug and okay.
Yeah. But it's not like something that's like heated in my life right now. I think that they're like, that's also normal. Like, that's a normal, like, okay, it's just not like, I'm just trying to pass and get my college degree and figure out life. And like, you know, stress affects that too, right? So if we have like sure. big stress parts in our life, like sex just goes down on the bottom part of our table. And like, you know, like, and if we've also created some good boundaries, right? Like this is the other place. If we know that like our boundaries are like, I'm not going to have sex until I get married. And I have this other stuff that's really active and involved in my life. Then like, yeah, that's not on my periphery right now. Now sex is also a normal part of intimacy. So the more intimate we get with someone, the more we feel the pressure to like be physically intimate with someone, and have sex. And so like, I think that that often changes, like when we see people get into like if they've decided I'm not going to have sex until marriage, I'm not in a like committed relationship. And so like, I've kind of put that on the side. Like when we get into those committed relationships, that can feel like a lot more pressure. But I also think that some of it culturally is like women are taught that they're not supposed to desire. They're supposed to be desired. And so desire as a whole gets put in a container that we just don't deal with. And so like, I'll just, you know, do whatever my partner wants to do because I just want to make him happy, because like our desire is to be desirable at that point. Like it's gotten hijacked in a way. Our ability to figure out what our own desire is on our own has been hijacked and co-opted into like, my desire is to keep the relationship desirable. And so that can be kind of fun to like filter through in therapy, not necessarily something that you figure out in your, you know, 20s trying to go through college. But yeah, like I think that those are all parts of it.
Well, let me ask this before, because we're reaching the end of our time and we want to be respectful of yours. You mentioned that the internet can be such a great place to find information and such a horrible place with misinformation. So for men and women trying to navigate this on their own or within their relationship, do you have any suggestions for how people can navigate the internet to find information that's going to be helpful and worthy and not get sucked into bad stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I have a few like CSAT, like the CSAT community is really good about resourcing with each other. And so like, I have some podcasts and things like that, that I definitely like recommend. I think in terms of like the internet, like I tell people, please don't Google it. Like talk to someone that you trust about it. Like if you have questions or concerns, like I always tell people like email someone that you respect or have questions for. I mean, for me, like in terms of female sexual health, the book Come As You Are by Emily Nagoski, I think is just imperative. Like I think that if you're looking at female sexual health, like I think it's a brilliant book. I really liked Peggy Orstein's Girls and Sex too. It's for a younger audience, right? But she's talking about, and Peggy specifically like has, she addresses some of the evangelical culture. And from what I understand, Peggy is also a like evangelical Christian. And so like, she does a really good job of like being respectful of the culture while also, addressing some of the pitfalls. And I mean, in my experience, being for women to have a group of people or even like teens to have, being a safe person to talk to is probably the like best, thing about it of like, let's just talk about experiences. Because in my experience, when you put women in a safe space and you allow them to just talk, they may create some like narratives and that might have to be off, but just ask the questions like, did you experience this? Do you understand what this experience is?
And safe space for women, as with men, is a lot of listening before judgment and before answering. And I love that you're basically saying, hey, we're talking about intimacy issues. We should probably do that in groups of intimate people and not alone on the internet. I don't know. Seems like that's what you're saying.
Yeah, that is it. That is exactly what I'm saying. Or like, you know, like I tend to be the person that Googles in my friend group, right? They'll text me and be like, what is this word? What does this mean? I don't know, but I'll look it up, right? But I also think, right, really what I think has to happen, and this is something that I have preached since I was in college, is for us to have healing for female sexuality, we have to have healing between the genders. We have to have men listening to women's experiences and having empathy for that. And we have to have women understanding how difficult it is for men in the same space and creating a common language. Because I don't think that we do that well, right? Like when I was in youth group, we split off for the sex conversations. Yeah. The girls were in a room and the boys were in a room. And I think that that was created to create safety. But what it actually created is we got two different narratives of sex.
Yeah, right.
And and we didn't get to call that out, right? Like, so as a female, I didn't get to say like, wait a minute, why am I responsible for his thoughts and he doesn't get to be responsible for mine? And so like it created an echo chamber. And I think that when we start to say like, wow, like I didn't realize that, you know, we have never had, a government supported menopause thing. Like that seems extremely ridiculous that we have been treating this like it's just annoying to men, but like, we don't have any research on this, right? Like, I think it takes that. I think it takes some like empathy and like, wow, like, yeah, if you were taught your entire life that you, that sex was just this uncontrollable thing that you were required to have, like, that's going to be really lonely. And if that's the only language that you know, like, let's find a better way to have intimacy.
Well, Rachel, go ahead, Nate. You're going to ask the same question.
A couple of questions. First of all, do you work remotely with clients or is all of your stuff in person?
I do work remotely in remotely with clients. I'm about 50-50.
Okay. All right. And for those of our listeners who might want to contact you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, they can contact me through my professional website, which is Healing Path Recovery. Mm-hmm. And or they can contact me on my email, which is Rachel, R-A-C-H-E-L. healingpaths@gmail.com
All right. Wonderful. Well, what an enlightening and an enjoyable conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us, Rachel.
And, thanks for having me.
I'm quite confident that you're going to hear from some of our folks. And you know what? Let's go ahead and do the wrap now. Listeners, we'd love to hear also some feedback on this episode. And as you know, you can reach us at piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Well, that's it for this episode of the podcast. Until next time. Oh, I don't know whether you know our routine here for the wrap, Rachel, but we say our names. We close by introducing ourselves, saying our first name. We say goodbye with our name. So we're going to include you in the close, okay?
Okay.
So here we are. It's it's the end of the episode. Until next time, I'm Nate.
I'm Aaron.
And I'm Rachel.
And we are your pals on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
The Pirate Monk Podcast is produced by members of the Samson Society. Send your feedback or questions to piratemonkpodcast@gmail.com. Please give us a 5-star review on iTunes and share the podcast with a friend. For more information, please visit SamsonSociety.com.